hadn't killed anybody, but he knew that he'd been full to the brim with ill will, and still was. And he thought of a burning key, and he wasn't sure. He believed he would have remembered going to the edge of the city, and yet he wasn't sure. He asked who had seen him set the fire, but nobody would tell him. Giacomo and Le Porello were so quiet that Arcadi feared the worst. But when he got a chance to look at them, he saw that one of the policemen had somehow got a muzzle and leash on Le Porello, and was making gestures that indicated all would be well as long as Giacomo stayed where he was. After a few more denials from Arcadi, his friends were removed from the room. Giacomo asked why and was told that his friend had killed people and wouldn't admit it, so he was going to have to be talked to until he admitted it. At this, Giacomo turned to Arcadi and said, "But how could Arcadi do this when he is so good?" Arcadi forgot that his words could be taken as a confession and asked his friend to understand that he hadn't meant to do it. "I didn't mean it. I didn't know." Giacomo nodded at these words and said, "Yes, I understand." Satisfied with Arcadi's self-incrimination, the officer, holding Le Porello, allowed the dog to stand on his hind legs and pat Arcadi's cheek, and then his own face. He repeated this a few times as a way of reassuring Arcadi that he would be by Giacomo's side until the truth came out. Le Porello seemed confident that the truth would come out very soon, and Arcadi remembered the Vizsla puppy. He tried to drive away and was glad he'd failed at that. Though Arcadi broke down and confessed after being shown photographs of the 5 men and 4 women who died in the fire, his confession was never entirely satisfactory. He got the timing and exact location of the fire he'd set wrong, and his statement had to be supplemented with information from his former landlord, who identified him as the culprit before a jury, pointing at Arcadi, as he described the clothing the police had found him wearing the morning they arrested him. The inconsistencies in Arcadi's account troubled the authorities enough to imprison him in a cell reserved for the craziest bastards, the ones who had no inkling of what deeds they might be capable of doing until they suddenly did them. Arcadi's meals were brought to him, and his cell had an adjoining washroom that he kept clean himself. He no longer had to do long strings of mental arithmetic, shaving figures off the allowance for food as he went along. After a few days, his mind cleared. He stopped imagining that Giacomo and Le Porello were staring mournfully from the neighboring cell. And he could have been happy if he hadn't been facing imprisonment for deaths he dearly wished he could be sure he hadn't caused. His cell was impregnable, wound round with a complex system of triggers and alarms. Unless the main lock was opened with the key that had been made for it, he couldn't come out of that cell alive. The tyrant held the key to Arcadi's cell, and liked to visit him in there and taunt him with weather reports. He hadn't been interested in the crimes of the other crazy bastards who'd once inhabited this cell, so they'd been drowned. But as somebody who had, by his own admission, dispatched people and then gone straight to sleep afterward, Arcadi was the only other person within reach that the tyrant felt he had a meaningful connection with. Arcadi barely acknowledged his questions, but unwittingly gained the affections of the guards by asking a variant of the question, "Shouldn't you be staying here in this cell with me, you piece of shit?" each time the tyrant said his farewells for the day. As per tyrannical command, the guards withheld Arcadi's meals as punishment for his impudence, but they didn't starve him as long as they could have. One night, Arcadi even heard one of the guards express doubt about his guilt. The guard began to talk about buildings with doors that could all be opened with the same key. "He'd heard something about those keys," he said, but the other guard didn't let him finish. "When are you going to stop telling old wives' tales? That's what I want to know. Anyway, no landlord would run his place that way." Locum agreed to marry the tyrant on the condition that there would be no more drownings, And he sent Irene the First and Irene the Fair across the border and into a neighbouring country so that he could begin his new life free of their awkward presence. After a long absence, the tyrant appeared before Arkady to tell him this news, and to inform him that he'd lost the key to Arkady's cell. The key couldn't be recut either, since he'd had the only man with the requisite expertise drowned a few years back. Locum had a point about the drownings being counterproductive, the tyrant realized. "Sorry about that," he said. "Maybe it'll turn up again one of these days. But if you think about it, you are going to be here for life, anyhow." "No problem," Arkady said. And since it was looking as if this was the last time the tyrant was going to visit him, he added casually, "Give my regards to Locum." The tyrant looked over at the prison guards to check whether they had seen and heard what he'd just seen and heard. "Did he just lick his lips?" he asked in shock. The guards claimed they couldn't confirm this, as they'd been scanning the surrounding area for possible threats. "Spring the lock so that the cell kills him," the tyrant ordered as he left. The guards unanimously decided to sleep on this order. It wasn't unheard of for the tyrant to rethink his decisions. The following day, the tyrant still hadn't sent word, so the guards decided to sleep on it another night, and another, until they were able to admit to themselves and to each other that they just weren't going to follow orders this time. Their first step toward rebellion, finding out that disobedience didn't immediately bring about the end of the world. The prison guards cautiously went into dialogue with their counterparts at the palace and at border crossings, and a quiet, steady exodus began. The neighboring countries welcomed the escapees, and with them the opportunity to remove the tyrant's power at the same time as playing a prank on him, by helping him to empty out his territory. If the tyrant noticed that the streets were quieter than usual, he simply said to himself, "I suppose I really did have a lot of these people drowned, didn't I?" It probably wouldn't have helped him one way or the other to notice that as the living people left, the marshland stretched out farther and farther, slowly pulling houses and cinemas, greengrocers, restaurants and concert halls down into the water. If you looked down into the swamps, which he never did, it was possible to see people untangling their limbs and hair, courteously hanging each other body parts and keys, resuming residence in their homes, working out what crops they might raise and which forms of energy they could harness. Meanwhile, the tyrant was congratulating himself for having dealt with Arkady. He had disliked the way Locum had begged for Arkady's life, and cared even less for her expression upon being told her pleas came too late. He didn't think they'd had a love affair. That lanky pyromaniac could only dream of being worthy of Locum's attention. But Locum's behavior was too similar to that of the man Irene the First loved. What was wrong with these people? The tyrant set Locum alight on their wedding day. Thanks to Arkady, fire had risen to the top of his list of elimination methods. He forced her to walk to the end of the longest bridge, spanning the marshlands, and he drenched her in petrol and struck a flame. He'd given no real thought to decreasing his own flammability, so the event was referred to as an attempted murder-suicide. Attempted, because when he tried to run away, the burning woman ran after him, shouting that she just that moment discovered something very interesting. He couldn't kill her. He could never kill her. She took him in her arms and fed him to the fire he'd started. There was still quite a lot of him left when he jumped into the swamp, but the drowned held grudges and heaved him out onto land again, where he lay roasting to death while his bride strolled back toward the city, peeling blackened patches of wedding dress off her as she went. She put on some other clothes and took food to the prison, where Arkady sat alone contemplating the large heap of questionable publications the guards had left him on their departure. Before Arkady could thank Lokum for the food, and, he hoped, her company, she said, "Wait a minute," and ran off again, returning an hour later with his two friends. Leporello shook Arkady's hand, and Giacomo licked his face. This was a joke they'd vowed they'd make the next time they saw Arkady, and they thought it rather a good one. Arkady called out his thanks to Lokum, but she had no intention of staying this time either. "We've got to get you out of there," she said, and left again. "It's autumn, isn't it?" Arkady asked Giacomo. He'd seen that Giacomo's shoes and Leporello's feet were soaking wet, too, but he wanted to finish eating before he asked about that.
"Yes. How did you know?"
"I don't know. Could you bring me some leaves, just a handful?" Giacomo brought armfuls of multicolored leaves, and Leporello rushed through them like a blizzard so that the richest reds and browns flew in through the prison bars.
"Giacomo."
"Yes, Arkady." "Is it right for me to escape this place? Those people where we used to live. There was a fire and they couldn't get out. They would have got out if they could, but they couldn't, and that's what killed them. If you can escape, then you should. But am I to blame?" Giacomo didn't say yes or no, but attempted to balance a leaf on the tip of Leporello's nose. What about Irene the Fair? For months she'd been living quite happily in a big city where most of the people she met were just as vague as she was, if not more so. She ran a small and cozy drinking establishment and passed her days exchanging little-known facts with customers, in between attending to the finer details of business management. Her mother had drowned soon after their arrival in the new city. This might have been an accident, but Irene thought not. The River Danube ran through her new city of residence, and her mother had often said that if she could drown in any river in the world, she wished for it to be the Danube. A liquid road that would take her body to the Carpathians and onward until it met the Iskar as it crossed the Balkan Mountains, washing her and washing her until she lost all scent of the life she'd lived. Then let the Iskar take her to lie on beds of tiny white flowers in old, old glades, high up on the slopes. Or if she stayed with the Danube, let it draw her along miles and miles of canals to collect pine needles in the black forest. As many as her lap could hold. Thinking of her mother's words, Irene the Fair had journeyed farther up the river and given the ashes into its care. Arrivals from her father's territory frequented her bar and freely cursed the tyrant's name as they told tales that intrigued her. If what these people were saying was true, then the tyrant's drownings had come to an end. It was said that her father's territory was mostly underwater now, that there was no king, no flag, and no soldiers, that there were only cities of the drowned, who looked as if they were having a good time down there. Irene the Fair heard that one of the only pieces of land yet to be submerged was notable for having a large prison on it. The man who told Irene this paused for a moment before asking if he could buy her a drink, and she left an even longer pause before accepting. He was handsome, but the scent of his cologne was one she very strongly associated with loan sharks. Even so, can't loan sharks also be caring boyfriends, or at the very least, great in bed? "Hi, excuse me, sorry for interrupting," a glamorous newcomer said, as she took a seat at the bar beside the probable loan shark. "Can we talk in private?" All Lokum wanted to know was what Irene the Fair had taken with her when she'd left the palace. Irene had neither the time nor the inclination to provide a list of articles to her father's plaything, but Lokum rephrased her question to ask if Irene had taken anything of her father's while leaving the palace. And then Irene remembered the key, just a metal shape on his dressing table, bigger than most keys she'd seen, but still small enough to pocket, while she bade her father farewell and hoped she'd manage to inconvenience him one last time. Just before she and Locum reached the prison gates, Irini the Fair looked over the side of their boat and saw that her mother had found her way to the drowned city that now surrounded the building. She wasn't alone. There was a man with her, the one Irini the Fair had never met but wanted to. They both waved, and Irini the First held up a finger and then wistfully rocked an invisible baby, motions easily interpretable as an appeal for grandchildren. "Lovely," Irini the Fair murmured, drawing her head back into the boat and pretending she hadn't seen that last bit.
Presents. Jill Ackerman's husband had been wanting to have a talk with her for weeks, and she was 200% sure that it was going to be an unpleasant one. The signs were subtle, but she was a psychologist. So was he. She'd been warned that this would probably be her toughest marriage. In the month before their summer holiday, he was so busy that she hardly saw him at home, and when he was in, she used the unofficial zoning of their household to postpone the talk. No harsh words were to be said in bed or in the kitchen. Neither of them had made these rules, but since this had somehow become part of their code of conduct, Jill and Jacob continued to do their bit toward keeping their meals and their dreams untainted. Conversation in the bedroom and the kitchen tended toward the light-hearted, so she stuck to those rooms as often as possible when she wasn't at work. Jacob had had the house renovated to her wishes. There weren't many changes, just the addition of a few extra doorways. She preferred rooms with a minimum of two doorways, so you had options. You didn't have to go out the same way you came in. In the bedroom, she moved from the bed to the floor and back again with her books and gadgets. Sex was out of the question. He didn't even raise the question, just watched her with a glint of amusement in his eyes. In the kitchen, she cleaned diligently and sharpened knives until they broke. Jacob bought more and presented them to her with witty asides she heard only dimly beneath the louder fear that he might add, "Can I see you in the living room for a minute?" He did catch her in the living room once, but she ran so fast round the edge of the room and out of the nearest door that she toppled and broke a painted jug they'd chosen together on their honeymoon. Jill wouldn't have minded receiving some advice, but ultimately opted not to mention this situation to anybody outside of the marriage, not to her own therapist, and certainly not to Lena or Sam. Jacob was about to leave her. She didn't want him to. But this was her third marriage and his second. She knew how these things went. She'd met Jacob's new colleague over dinner, and the colleague, Vivian, was well-dressed, husky-voiced, and generally delightful company, knowledgeable on a number of topics and curious about a variety of others. Jill had found herself joining Jacob in addressing her as Vi, and when Vi left the table for a few moments to answer a phone call, Jill whispered, "You realize she's got a crush on you?" Jacob laughed and leaned toward her with his lips all smoochy, but she pushed his face away with a breadstick. "Did you hear what I just said?" He leaned in again, not close enough for a kiss this time, but close enough for her reflection to almost completely fill his irises. Portrait of cross 42-year-old with, hey, really nice boobs, actually. "Yes, you said you think Vi has a crush." "I'm 200% sure about that."
200%? Oh, even if you're right, it'll pass, Jay.
Jay, Vi, and he still called his first wife Dee. "Why don't you just make the most of it, run off with her, and be half of a beautiful black intellectual couple, just like you always wanted?" Husbands one and two, Max and Sam, were white. Sam was a few years younger than Jill, but both he and Max tended to look old, stood beside her. Well, not elderly, just older than her. whereas side by side she and Jacob looked about the same age. What age was that? If you didn't know them, you couldn't even give a rough estimate. Jacob picked up a breadstick of his own, crunched half of it, stabbed her in the arm with the other half, and asked, "Do you really think you can do this here?" He rarely appeased her. She wasn't sure what to make of that, given his attitude toward almost all his other friends, loved ones, clients, the efforts he made to ensure everybody else's comfort. When he was with Jill, he made her wonder whether he'd been sent to destroy her. Take the time she'd invited him to sample the first viable batch of tea leaves from the greenhouse she part owned. Chun Mei, with its taste of sweet springtime grass. He'd sauntered downstairs inexplicably, wearing a denim shirt over jeans, taken the teacup from her, and filled his cheeks with tea.
"And how is this superior to a nice cup of Tetley?"
The combination of barbaric taste buds and denim on denim had set Jill's teeth so sorely on edge that her jaw locked for a couple of minutes. Enough time for him to stare her down and walk out unadmonished. He knew what he was doing. He knew. For her part, she'd given up trying not to be quite so in love with him at some point in their late teens, when she'd clocked that, without deliberately cultivating any particular scent, Jacob Wallace managed to smell exactly like a just-blown-out candle. But if the feelings on his side weren't there anymore, then it was better for him to just go. His contributions to their joint bank account tripled hers, but she wouldn't have a problem doing without hand-woven rugs at home and boutique hotels abroad. Doing without Jacob himself was going to make her a little bit crazy for a long time, so no, she wasn't going to make it easy for him to say his piece and then leave. With a week to go before their summer holiday, Jacob all but ambushed Jill at a tube station. She was adding another month's worth of public transport to her Oyster card when an arm slipped around her neck and her husband murmured,
"Jill, Jill, you can't fight this any longer. I need to ask you something."
She could have feigned alarm for just a couple more moments and elbowed him in the groin, but instead she turned her head and hissed,
"Whose idea was it to get married in the first place, eh? Why don't you ask around and get back to me?"
She wasn't going to let him off just like that, but he'd better not be hoping she'd cling to him either. If she didn't feel like being on her own, she could get another husband, if she wanted. Jill had run into Max outside their friend Mary's bakery the other day, and he'd held her at arm's length, given her a long, admiring look, and said,
"God, you're deteriorating fast. Lucky me. Getting out while the going was good, eh?"
His eyes directly contradicting his remarks. Not that she'd ever go back to Max, with whom wedded bliss had been nowhere to be found. It had made her nervous that almost all her new in-laws were Swiss bankers, but also there were the terrific night-long rows she and Max got into. If she protested Max's shameless revisionism by making reference to something he himself had said just the day before, he'd become concerned about her negativity, or would hit her with some barbed comment somebody else had apparently made to him about her demeanor. It wasn't clear whether he made them up or merely saved them. She never stopped liking Max, but did grow weary at the thought of him. Jill went over to the blue stand where issues of the Evening Standard were stacked, but Jacob handed her his copy.
"I know whose idea it was to get married," he said. "I don't need to ask around. I was there. And so were you. Just another stunner among the many, many stunners of London town, drunk on a sofa with one of your best mates."
"Excuse me?" The best mate may have been legless, but seeing as I'm a hero of the kingdom of alcohol, I was mildly tipsy. Also, don't forget to mention that this best mate was a moderately attractive man who never once made so much of a hint of a move on me in all the 28 years we'd known each other.
Maybe he thought it was too obvious. I mean, Jack and Jill. Anyway, the two of you were 39 years old, prime of life, and both solvent to boot. So the man plucked up the courage to say, "Hang on, what did I say again? Do you think that maybe we're able to love someone best when that person doesn't know how we feel?" That's what Jacob had said, and she'd looked at him and asked if he was about to say something weird to her. She'd rather he didn't. Having weird things said to her was a large part of her day job, and why couldn't she have time off? Jacob's answer was that he was about to say something weird, but only a tiny bit, and maybe what he wanted to say wouldn't come out sounding as wrong as they thought it would. Maybe it would sound normal. "Let's get married and have sublime blazing babies before it's too late," Jacob had blurted after she'd nodded at him to continue. Jill stretched an arm out and refilled both their shot glasses. It was already too late for babies. She'd had a sort of deadly serious running joke with both her previous husbands that having children would have to wait until the war's over. But none of the ongoing wars looked likely to ever end, and she could no longer see carrying a child in her future. Not physically. And not mentally, either. Maybe that had always been the case. "I'm not going to marry you, mate." "Oh. That's... well, I mean, why not? Because I said blazing. Because we haven't known each other for long enough." In her head, she'd replied, "Because I can't just keep getting married all the time, and also because I'm pissed off with you for making me sit through two of my own weddings and one of yours before it occurred to you that maybe we should have tried it together first." Aloud, she'd said that they were too old, adding that they didn't need to get married. She said they could just see each other if he wanted. She advised sleeping the question off. Maybe he'd wake up and realize that he only wanted to get married when he drank a lot of soju. "But that wasn't good enough for the rejected suitor," Jacob continued, settling down into the tube seat beside hers. He'd been wanting to marry this woman for ages. Long before the adult realization that marriage isn't all that necessary. So he proposed again the following evening. "The babies don't have to happen," he said, and then he sang the cheesiest Korean song he could find. Was Jacob about to sing "What's Wrong with My Age" right there on the tube with all these boys and girls and men and women looking? They were already looking, since he hadn't bothered to keep his voice down. Still, she stuck up for "What's Wrong with My Age." "It's not a cheesy song. It's your singing that makes it cheesy. I love that song." "Me too, but I'm afraid it is inherently cheddar, Jay." Jacob turned to Jill, opened his arms, and sang in Korean of staring into the mirror and bidding time to stand aside. The lyrics sprang to her own lips as she listened, and by the time he was challenging her to deny that his age was the perfect age for love, she was smiling the words right back at him. As he sang, she realized something. He hadn't been thinking about leaving her. Whatever he'd been working up to asking her, it was about something else entirely. She placed a finger over his lips. "And when they wed, their parents and all their friends stood up in the church pews and sang, 'At last.'" But Jacob made a half-hearted attempt to bite her, then said, "Hey! Hey, Jill, are you thinking about leaving me?" She didn't answer that. One of the things she'd learned about him early on was that he had an inbuilt and near-infallible lie detector. And all of a sudden she wasn't sure whether what she'd really been doing for the past few weeks was skillfully molding her own desire to be single again into an image of his. It could be that all Jill's leaving and being left had now made it impossible for her to stay with anyone. For most of their lives she and Jacob had both been afraid of the same thing, not being deemed worthy to share a home with a family. They were both foster kids. Nobody ever said you were unworthy, not to your face, but there was talk of adults and children not being the right fit for each other.
The adults were the ones who decided that, so when Fit was brought up, they were really talking about the child. This left Jacob and Jill and Lena, Jill's one-time foster sister, during an idyllic but brief lull, ever ready to have to leave a home or to be left. Jacob became extremely capable, a facilitator, someone you wanted around because he smoothed your path, whether through his skill as a polyglot or his general aura of can-do. Lena was pretty much lawless, used to wear a pair of sunglasses on the back of her head and a badge that said Hell, which she tapped whenever anyone asked her where she was originally from. And she was so clearly somebody that you could trust with your life that reform always seemed possible for her. Jill advanced an entirely false impression of herself as biddable and in need of protection. "Ah, I'm just a little chickadee who won't survive the winter unless I nestle under your life-sustaining wing." Far from original, but it worked. They went out to dinner at their favorite restaurant. The benefits were twofold. Delicious char-grilled broccoli, plus the discussion of Jacob's question, without having to bring it into the house with them. Jacob proposed sacrificing their summer holiday to a project of his, an idea he was developing as part of his work as a bereavement counselor. So that was it. The question he'd been building up to for weeks. "Do you mind giving up your holiday to test run my project?" She was embarrassed that he felt he'd had to work up to asking her this. It was a question that would have been easily raised and just as easily settled with an unselfish partner. Regarding him, her support was in fact unconditional, and to date she'd thought she adequately expressed this. Now she fought demoralization as she heard him out. His project focused on a particular type of experience that a large number of his clients reported having undergone.
"To oversimplify the descriptions I've been given, this experience presents as an implosion of memory, and as the subjects drift through the subsequent debris, they calmly develop a conviction that they do not do so alone. These presences aren't reported as ghostly, but living ones, minutes, sometimes hours, when the mourner feels as if they've either returned to a day when the deceased was still alive, or the deceased has just arrived in the present time with them. And what's interesting about these lapses people experience is that most of them happen under fairly similar physical conditions."
"So, you've put together some sort of program that induces this feeling of presence?"
"Well, that's what I'm aiming for. Of course, it'd only be for mourners who need that feeling from time to time and can't make it happen by themselves. We're calling it presence. And now we've got some funding."
"You clever thing."
"Really, it was Vi who got the funding together. She's a bit of a whiz at that. Lots of international contacts."
"I'm sure that's only the tip of Vi's iceberg." She made a quick attempt to estimate the extent to which new information concerning the relationship between Vi and Jacob might shake her. Sam had had his affairs, and Jill had come to an understanding of them as a form of boundary setting. Actions taken against a fear that any one person could or did know everything about you. Jill was never more aggravating than when she got busy understanding things. And yet these rationalizations of hers might not be such a big problem this time around, as she was finding that the thought of various deep, sweet secrets between Jacob and Vi had something of a mechanical effect on her. Air seeped out of her, and very little came back in. She breathed as though subject to strangulation, and sat on her hands to suppress tentacle-like tendencies such as thrashing about and clinging. The more Jacob told her about the testing of his program, the more she wondered if her first misgivings hadn't been right after all. He was genuinely willing to be a guinea pig for his own prototype, she could see that. But maybe this was also leaving Jill, phase one, practice. "Okay, I'll help. But since I don't know anyone else who'd ask me to spend 2 weeks pretending he's no longer in the world, tell me this first. "Are you really not thinking about leaving me?" she asked. That glint of amusement again.
"Get this through your head, Jill Ackerman. I'm not leaving you. And you... are you leaving me?"
"I'm not leaving you, Jacob Wallace." She watched him put her expression, posture, and phrasing through his lie detector. She passed. His gaze lost intensity.
"Remember that psychologist who said we had an unhealthy dependence on each other?"
asked the boy who'd learned Korean along with Jill and the couple who'd eventually adopted her. Her parents had wanted to have a new family language, and Jacob had learned too, so that he could be a part of that family. He'd been an honorary Ackerman for over half his life now.
"Yeah, we owe our careers to him, I think. He made us want to see what his job would be like if someone did it properly."
"He might have been right, though," Jacob said.
"Oh? I just mean, if it was healthy, it might be easier to give up."
She poured him more wine and they raised their glasses to unhealthy dependencies. Then he told her the specifics of their test for presents. They needed two bases. Jacob would stay at their Holland Park house with the projection of Jill's presence, and Jill would need to stay at her flat in Catford, a parting gift from Max that she would have rejected if that hadn't meant starting another fight with him. Jill's current tenants were away in Prague until the autumn, and when she called them to ask if they were all right with her being in the flat for a couple of weeks, they said it was fine.
"Just don't break anything," Rada said.
Workmen came to the flat to make some adjustments to wiring and to secrete the contents of what looked like gas canisters into the walls. Jacob gave her a full list of the substances she'd be breathing in. While they were all substances found unaltered in wildlife, mixing them was bound to be a different matter.
"This is essentially going to be like an acid trip that lasts for 2 weeks, isn't it?"
Jacob only said, "Not really. You'll see." After the necessary alterations had been made to both houses, Jill and Jacob recorded 3 conversations, the purpose of which was to place the mourner in the midst of a familiar exchange, the kind we're always having with friends and family, repeating ourselves and repeating ourselves, going over what we know about each other to prove that we still know these things and will not, cannot forget them. Vi set up a camera at Jacob's office and filmed Jacob's face as he and Jill repeated the conversation they'd had on the tube about whose idea it had been to get married. They talked about their earliest impressions of each other, too, and by the time it came to filming their third conversation, they couldn't think of anything else they wanted to say, so they kept it brief. Sex returned to the Ackerman-Wallace bedroom, to every room in their house, in fact, their sweat mingling in the summer heat. A day later, Vi provided them with a transcript of what they'd said in each of the conversations they'd filmed in Jacob's office. And Jill was irritated by this. Was this Vi's way of telling them to make certain that their claims matched up with what they really felt? Until she recalled that they were going to be filming all 3 conversations again in her own office, with the camera focusing on Jill's face this time. They had to make an effort to get the conversations in sync. If she or Jacob couldn't get hold of each other in their separate bases, they were to put headphones on and re-engage in the conversation, responding to each other's words, saying their own parts as they remembered them. Jacob phoned her when he and Vi arrived at the prison where she worked. The timing was inconvenient because Jill had just made accidental eye contact with the governor of the prison and had done what she usually did when that happened. She'd walked around the nearest corner to hide. She was well aware that the governor thought she was useless. Not Jill as an individual, necessarily, but her role within the framework of the prison.
"Letting young offenders have half an hour a week tapping out fuchsia landscapes on a chromatic typewriter doesn't really do much toward turning them into better citizens, does it?"
Not a fair summation of her work, but getting on with her job was Jill's only answer. amiable until some bureaucratic roadblock popped up. And once it had been dealt with, she was a nice person once more, even nicer than before. She and Jacob repeated their three conversations for the camera, and then she went back to work. Jill knew what all the boys had done, or as much as they would admit to, anyway. They all received treatment. They could talk to her as long as they tried to say what was true for them. Everything they said was recorded, and her office door stayed open whenever a boy was in there with her. There was a guard at the door, too, just in case, but problems between her and the boys were infrequent. Many of them called her Miss, quite tenderly.
"Tell me if anyone's rude to you, Miss. Just tell me his name, yeah?"
As if she was their favorite teacher at school. She had hope for them, even though the things they told her made her shake like a jellyfish when she got a moment in her office alone. Ben and Solomon were the two boys whose progress she dwelled on the most, and they came to see her that afternoon, one after the other. Ben was deeply introverted, coping relatively well with his incarceration, and mostly harmless. If only she could get him to express some or any emotion to her, so that she could confirm or revise these impressions of his coping and his harmlessness. He had language and could understand everything that was said to him, but his introversion was so deep that he often looked as if he no longer knew whether he'd spoken aloud or not. He was irked when she pressed him to answer her questions.
"I already answered, Miss."
A phone had recently been discovered in Ben's cell. There were no incoming or outgoing calls or messages recorded on it. Nobody could explain how Ben had come by the phone, but it was easy to tell how long he'd had it because the photo album was full of selfies he'd taken. He posed in exactly the same way in each one, fingers held up in a peace sign. Only the backgrounds were different. He favored empty rooms and, occasionally, the backdrop of two or more of his fellow inmates doing their best to bash each other's heads in. Solomon was much more communicative with her, but that didn't mean she understood him any better. His record was something of a puzzle, in that he'd only turned to a life of crime relatively recently. For the first 15 years of his life, his record was spotless. Then one day he'd approached a gang whose members had been torturing him on and off, joined, and became their leader. His explanation of the change he'd made, "It was time." Jill was aware that Solomon's younger brother had been struggling with illness for years, and that the brother's brain tumor had gone into remission when Solomon was 13. The beginning of Solomon's career of criminal violence coincided, if you could really call that a coincidence, with doctors detecting a recurrence of cancerous cells in his brother's brain. This made Jill afraid for Solomon, and afraid of him, too. He admitted to wanting to help his brother, but would say nothing more about it. He was like a boy in a fairy tale. There was a set of steps he was to follow, with no concession whatsoever as to how others viewed his actions. Then at the end of it all, there'd be a reward. Solomon had just heard from his family. His brother's cancer was back in remission, but the young man showed no relief. The news only deepened the look of concentration in his eyes. This is what Jill saw when she tried to see life Solomon's way. Your brother had been selected at random and hurt. So by selecting others at random and hurting them, you won relief for your brother. If that's how it was, then Solomon would eventually be compelled to select one more person at random and kill them, so that his brother could live. Much of what she said to him was mere diversion. Her attempt to knock down the tower of logic he was building. Sometimes she thought it was working. Sometimes he cried when she made him realize a little of what he was doing. He wasn't a sniffler, so the tapes didn't catch his remorse. And when she asked herself whether she'd support a recommendation for his early release a year from now, she very much doubted being able to do that. For a while he would hate his false friend, Dr. Ackerman, obsess, fixate, and possibly decide that the life he'd take for his brother's sake should be hers. She was only 100% sure of these things, and had no clear idea of how far the boy's attempt would progress before he was restrained or what injuries would be sustained. Perhaps none. Perhaps none. Still, it was Jill's duty to mention this likelihood, and she'd do so in her reports closer to the time.
"Have a good holiday, Dr. Ackerman," Solomon said at the end of their session,
the only boy to acknowledge they wouldn't be seeing each other for the next 2 weeks. Jill took her suitcase over to the Catford flat and slept there the night before presents was due to begin. Jacob wasn't dead to her yet, so they played at a long-distance love affair over the phone. Jill had Rada and Myrna's permission to take down any images that might interfere with Jacob's presence, so as she talked to her husband, she walked around the flat, dropping pictures of the intimidatingly photogenic couple and their puppet and human friends, hard to tell which was which, into a jewelry box. She heard no echoes of Max's ranting or her own frenzied screeching, and when she went into the bedroom, where she'd slept so that she wasn't tempted to injure Max in the night, she found it full of small stages, some cardboard, some wood and textile, and there were silky screens for casting shadows through, too. "Looks like only play fights are allowed in here now," Jill said to Jacob, and then as she opened the fridge and took note of its being crammed with bottles full of something called Kofola, "I was thinking, won't it be easier for you to get hold of my presents over there than it will be for me to get hold of yours over here? You've never been here."
"I'm curious about that, too," Jacob said. "People who end up using presents may need to be able to travel with it, use it in a new house, and so on."
2 minutes until midnight. She looked around at the pale blue walls, then out of the window, and into the communal garden. There was a night breeze, and the flowers were wide awake. "Is there a button I press to activate or something?"
"Vi's going to start it, remotely."
"For both of us?"
"Yes." "Good night, Jay."
"Good night." She drew the curtains, switched off the lights, and was knocked down onto the bed by a wave of darkness so utter her eyes couldn't adjust to it. It felt as if she'd fainted. That was what she liked about fainting, the restful darkness that bathed your eyelids. After what felt like an hour or two, she held her phone up to her face to check the time, still couldn't see anything, and decided she might as well just sleep. She woke up feeling chilly. Her feet were sticking out from under the covers. A head had been resting on the pillow beside hers. All the indentation marks were there. She picked up her notepad and wrote that down. Even though she'd made the marks herself, they contributed to a sense of not having slept alone. It was 12:30, the latest she'd woken up in a while, and the room temperature was unusual for an early afternoon in July. She checked the thermometer and wrote the temperature down. Low, but it felt even lower. She put two jumpers on, made tea, plugged headphones in, and called up the first recorded conversation on her computer screen. There was Jacob smiling at her, speaking. At a much lower pitch, she heard her voice answering his. "Your singing makes it cheesy. I love that song." There were strings of words that she remembered in the correct order, and she tried to say them before her recorded voice did, but the cold threw her off balance, and she was left just listening and watching instead of participating. She added that observation to the others in her notepad. A visit to her greenhouse in Seven Oaks yielded a discovery. She hadn't woken up at 12:30. 12:30 was still 2 hours away. When she checked her phone on the train, the time changed, and she asked five other overground passengers, six.
"Yes, yes, it really is 10:30.
Sam and Lena were at the greenhouse, tending to the tea plants beneath swiveling lamps. They were wearing matching floral print wellies, and Sam preempted her derision. Yeah, I know, we deserve each other. Jill hesitated before she told them about presents. What if they said, Jacob? Who's Jacob? Or reminded her in voices full of pity that Jacob had been gone for months now. She couldn't be confident in what she said to them when she'd just stepped out of an icebox into a sunny July day, and the time outside wasn't the same as the time in her flat. Well, they were her friends. If at all possible, your friends have a right to be notified when you've downright lost it. But it seemed she was still sane. Lena and Sam had a lot of questions. Lena kept checking her pupils, and they both wanted to come over to the flat and verify her experience. Lena was most intrigued by the wall clocks.
They all read 12:30. Did you hear them ticking?
Come to think of it, no. No ticking. And Sam wondered about the cold. Talk to Jacob. Maybe he'll test the next phase on you two. They said they'd like that. She didn't think she'd told them anything that made presents seem like good fun, so it was most likely that they were just being supportive. Sam gave her a pouchful of assam leaves.
Let me know what you think.
On the way home, she stopped at a supermarket and bought winter groceries. Lemsip, hot chocolate, ingredients for soup and for hot toddies. She put it all through self-checkout so she wouldn't have to make any small talk about summer colds. Then, wondering how Jacob was doing, she checked their joint account and saw that he'd made a card payment at a Waitrose about an hour ago, for more or less the same amount as she'd just spent. She wouldn't mention this in her notes. It was cheating. She shouldn't be able to guess whether or not he was cold, too. She'd forgotten to lock the front door. Just like waking up at 12:30, it had been years since she'd last done that. People told horror stories about Catford, but she would have been more worried about going in if it was the Holland Park front door she'd forgotten to lock. The stakes were higher over there. She dumped her shopping bags in the kitchen and went back to the front door, locking it behind her with exaggerated care. Jacob came out of the room filled with puppet stages and looked around him, nodding.
"Not bad," he said.
According to the clock just above his head, it was still 12:30. He took a step toward her, and she took a step back.
"What are you doing here?"
"Why are you shivering?"
he asked back.
"Because it's bloody cold in here?"
He held out his hand for her to touch. He was warm, and she closed both her hands around his palm. He winced, removed his hand from hers, and brought her two more jumpers to put on. He didn't need to be told where to find the jumpers. She went back into the kitchen, found her notepad, and made a note of that. Then she put the kettle on, and Jacob asked if he should do the same with the central heating.
"Yes, please."
She measured tea into a teapot, put the shopping away in the cupboards. The tea brewed, and then she and Jacob sat down in the living room. He took a couple of sips and said,
"Remind me how this is superior to a nice cup of Tetley."
She couldn't really taste the tea herself. She was sweating, and Jacob wasn't. He was comfortable, right at home. She took a jumper off to see if she'd feel the cold less that way. Putting on jumpers and turning on the heating only seemed to increase the cold. When she looked at Jacob from the side, she could see that he wasn't her husband. He had no shadow, and he didn't smell like her husband. He didn't smell of anything. He was warm, and he could drink tea and be snarky about the tea, and perhaps she would have been more willing to keep him around if he'd been shadowless but smelled right. But the way things were, she was too conscious of this person not really being Jacob.
"Sorry, but I think you'd better go," she said, checking her watch for some reason.
"It's 12:30. Time for you to go." He set his cup down on the coffee table.
"Okay. But if you tell me to leave, I won't come back."
She patted his knee. That's fine. Thanks for understanding. He stood up, and so did she.
I'm leaving, but everything that's between us will stay.
She couldn't help laughing at that.
You're so soppy, Jacob.
He laughed too, then put an abrupt break on the laughter.
I didn't mean it in a soppy way.
Okay. Bye.
Good to see you, he said, and left the room.
She stayed still for hundreds of heartbeats and thousands of shivers, but didn't hear the front door open or close. At 12:30, she got up and made sure that he was gone. Then she recorded the entire encounter in her notebook and broke a rule of the test by phoning Jacob.
If you tell me to leave, I won't come back. Now that she thought about it, she didn't like the sound of that.
Jacob took a long time to answer the phone. She'd almost given up when his voice came down the line.
Jay?
Jacob, are you okay?
Yeah. You?
Fine. Just. Have you seen me at home yet?
No, not yet, he said.
Something else had happened. He'd gone out for a bit and come back to find the front door open. She bit her lip so that she didn't interrupt him. And an intruder in the hall. Some old black guy, talking at him in Portuguese, begging forgiveness for something.
Did you call the police?
Jacob was silent.
You didn't call the police, Jacob?
He thought the intruder might have been his dad.
You know, my bio dad. I got him to slow down, and he seemed to be talking about how I'd weighed on his conscience.
Interesting. Is he still there with you?
Nah. Once I realized who he was or might be or whatever, I told him to get the fuck out. And guess what he said?
He said, okay, but if you tell me to leave, I won't come back.
And I said, well, you'd best not.
And then he said, I'm leaving, but everything that's between us will stay?
No, he didn't say that.
And hang on, how did you...
Jacob's voice fizzed and wavered, stopped altogether, and was replaced by a smoother, happier version. Audio of the second conversation they'd filmed.
To be honest, Jill, I didn't think you were going to get adopted. You played too many mind games with the people who tried to take you on. When you were together in public, you'd act all cowed and hurry to do everything they said, acting as if they beat you at home. And you didn't eat at home either, did you?
No. I'd stuff my face in school, so it looked like I wasn't getting fed.
Looking back, I was a scary kid, Jill said, in perfect time with the recording of her own voice.
But the Ackermans just kept telling you they really liked you, and even when you pulled stunts like that, Sabine would say, nope, sorry, and God help us, but we still really like you. And she and Carol wouldn't eat until you ate.
So then I'd worry that I'd brought them to the brink of collapse and ended up spoon-feeding them rice, 2 spoons for each of them, and then 1 for me, important to keep your strength up when you've got parents to feed. There was no room to ask what had happened. Jacob had been there on the other end of the line, but now he was gone, and it was a week ago again. The blue wall in front of her was more pacifying than sky, its color more even. Icicles hung from her nostrils. They were long, thin, and pearly gray, like enchanted spindles, Jill thought. But it was only mucus, so she reached for tissues. She and Jacob were talking about the Wallaces now. Jill had always been sure that Jacob would get adopted. It was just a question of his coming across grown-ups who didn't try to pull the wool over his eyes. Even the whitest of lies made him act out, and then he was discovered not to be the right fit. But along came Greg and Petra Wallace, and it was heartwarmingly weird that a pair of super-white conservative politicians had fallen for Jacob as hard as they had. It took a long time for their foster son to stop anticipating some hidden motive on their part.